debate. It's a lost art form, especially in regards to soccer during the internet age. This is why the First 11 exists. The First 11 pits pseudo-soccer journalists against each other in a battle for the ages. Here, the week's arbitrarily named top 11 American soccer issues are laid out. Our panelists pick a side and debate ensues. There are no winners. There are no losers. There are no points awarded. There is just reverently irreverent discourse over primarily ridiculous topics that deserve our discussion, or at least rambling opinions of the otherwise ignored. So prepare to be simultaneously amused and aggrieved. This is the First 11. Today is December 10th, 2013, and welcome to the brand new world of the First 11. We're living in a world where Jason Christ no longer coaches Real Salt Lake, where Sporting Kansas City is the MLS Cup champions, and Real Salt Lake, speaking of them, is cursed.
Allegedly.
Completely.
Yeah. All right, I'm Evan Ream at Evan Ream, a pseudo kind of real journalist and kind of pseudo not really real at all English teacher.
And I'm Abram Chamberlain. I am definitely a pseudo journalist, as I barely write except for once every couple of months, just ask Steve Storr. And I am a real English teacher, so to speak.
Ooh.
We are going to jump in right away with our number one on the First 11.
Number one.
I've been obsessed a little bit over Real Salt Lake's sort of lack of winning anything of merit since 2009. They won their one MLS Cup, went on sort of an unprecedented run. I was even so excited about this that I went and made, either you call it a movie trailer or a short film, I don't know how you want to look at it, called The Ghosts of Monterey. Because I believe that this one is completely true. So number one on our First 11 reads as follows. Real Salt Lake, losers of the MLS Cup, are cursed.
I disagree with this. Maybe they've gotten a little unlucky. Bad refereeing decision here and there. Hitting the post a couple times, but they're not cursed. I mean, let's remember right now, they won MLS Cup because the best penalty kick taker of all time in MLS, Landon Donovan, skied one into almost out of then Quest Field in Seattle. They lost one MLS Cup on a penalty shootout. They won one MLS Cup on a penalty shootout. Seems like 50-50 to me. Yes, they lost to DC United this year at home. Yes, they lost to Monterey at home. But you can't really call a team cursed because they lost three games and won one. They still won 25% of their championship games that they've been in. It's not like they're the New England Revolution or anything.
All right, first off, go screw yourself. second off, all right, so they won that first MLS Cup, some might say a bit luckily, and you pointed out the fact that it was Mr. Landon Donovan who more or less handed them the MLS Cup on a silver platter. But since that time, you have Jason Christ coming out and saying that the team is going to go all in on Champions League, and the team looked legitimately like it was going all in on Champions League. And quite frankly, they should have won Champions League in 2011. But they lost the Champions League final at home. Now, that's understandable. You lose to a Mexican team, a very good Mexican team, sort of the most dominant team in the CONCACAF region in Monterrey. But after losing that, they sort of went on an epic struggle to, you know, sort of pick up form in MLS again, despite their 34-game home unbeaten streak prior to that loss. More importantly than losing to Monterrey, again, that's completely acceptable. They lost to DC United this year in the U.S. Open Cup final. Do I need to repeat who they lost to? DC United. Statistically, the worst team in MLS history. Losing MLS Cup again this year, despite the fact that they dominated good portions of that game on penalty kicks again. And most importantly, they just lost Jason Christ. This team is clearly cursed by the Ghosts of Monterey. Cheap plug.
Are you saying that DC United's a bad team?
DC United is a horrendous team.
Horrendous team. All right, well, you guys should all check out Abram's video, Ghosts of Monterey. You can find it on his website, Viva La Football.
Yeah. Viva La Football. And I tweet it out about 18 times a day.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty sweet, actually. I watched it all the way through.
Yeah, so all 5 minutes of it.
Number two.
In MLS Cup this past Saturday, MLS Cup MVP was won by Aurelien Collin, who scored the game-tying goal and hit the winning penalty kick in the game. Now, Aurelien Collin led the league this year with, I believe, 13 yellow cards, and he got another one in MLS Cup. But he also had a number of a couple of other fouls that he possibly could have been given a second yellow for, and one foul that was not called on Robbie Finley, which he could have been given a yellow card for as well. So number two on the first 11 says Aurelien Collin should have been sent off in MLS Cup on Saturday.
I have not done a lot of refereeing, at least a lot of soccer refereeing in my life. I do have to disagree with this one pretty full-heartedly. You can't go back and completely change a decision, obviously. And we have, as we all say, the benefit of instant replay, of going back and looking at fouls on Robbie Finley, which weren't called, and saying that's clearly a foul. In the heat of the moment, in a full-speed game, it's not. Now, that yellow card, a lot of people are looking back at it now and saying that should have been a red card. I disagree with that. But more important than the fact that he wasn't sent off, this is Aurelien Collin. This is possibly the sexiest man in MLS. He's playing in this incredibly unsexy game, and do you really want to take out the sexiness of that game by removing him from it?
Aurelien Collin is not even close to being the sexiest man in MLS. Have you seen Kyle Beckerman's hair? I mean, I think you just say enough said. No, I mean, he totally and completely should have been sent off. I don't know why he wasn't. Maybe the referee was worried about ruining the game, but there was a foul on Robbie Finley where Robbie Finley had this beautiful first. Is Robbie Finley good at soccer, by the way? I'm so confused. He had this beautiful first touch right by Collin and I'm thinking of a different time. He did have a couple good first touches, though. But there was one where Collin just sort of took him out from behind, and the ref didn't even call a foul. And it seemed like a pretty egregious foul to me and a definite yellow card. I don't think there's any way that Aurelien Collin should have been on the field for the entirety of this game. He had too many fouls, too many hard fouls, and too many dumb fouls. It's not even a question to me. Aurelien Collin should have been sent off.
But with him and with with Sporting Kansas City in general, that's essentially how they play. And unless the ref reels it in early, he can't go out giving a red card or a yellow card that late in the game. If he had the game under control earlier, the ref, and I apologize, I don't remember who it was. All I know is it wasn't Geiger who it should have been.
It was Hilario Grajeda, sound right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It wasn't Geiger. Geiger's the best ref in MLS, so Geiger should have been reffing every single MLS Cup final ever. But you can't just go and start handing out red and yellow cards late in the game just because, especially when he hasn't called, you know, four of the seven. And maybe he should have been sent off, but I think it's less of a Aurelien Collin should have been sent off and more of a this referee should have had this game more under control.
You're right. This was more rigged than the World Cup draw.
Obviously.
Obviously.
Right.
Number three.
Watching, and I've, you know, again, plugging my video, watching The Ghost of Monterey, making that video, I got to watch Lavelle Palmer take his penalty kick about 15 times. It was a horrible penalty take. I will agree that. Number three on our first 11, however, states Nick Raimondo should have taken a penalty before Lavelle Palmer.
So there's this old story that I can't remember which broadcaster told, that about a scout coming to a U.S., I think, under 17 game or something like that to scout Nick Raimondo, and it might have been a college scout or something like that for UCLA. They were really pissed off because when they got there, Nick Raimondo was not playing in goal. Nick Raimondo was playing right back. He is so athletic. He's so good with his feet that they just put him there at right back, and he was playing, and no one noticed that he was not even a field player. Nick Raimondo takes goal kicks all day. He probably takes penalties in practice. Some of the best penalty takers in the world are goalkeepers. I don't think Nick Raimondo would be bad at taking a penalty. I think he would be better than many of the players on Salt Lake at taking a penalty. I think Nick Raimondo should have stepped up ahead of Borchers. He should have stepped up again ahead of Lavelle Palmer. If you have a trophy riding on one penalty kick, would you rather have your backup left back take it or your starting goalkeeper and one of the leadership figures on your club? There's no question in my doubt that Nick Raimondo should have taken this penalty, especially because he's so good with his feet. It just seems ridiculous that Lavelle Palmer would step up and take it ahead of him. You know, Raimondo's such a Ricardo-esque goalkeeper anyway that he could have definitely nailed something like this and become a legend not only in club history but also in MLS history.
Yeah, and he would have become an MLS legend. I'm not quite sure he isn't an MLS legend already. That said, you can't use your goalkeeper to take a penalty kick prior to a field player. Not because there's a rule against it, because there's no logic to it. Going back to Jason Kreis and the fact that he's no longer coaching Real Salt Lake, which, you know, the news broke about 15 minutes before we started recording. If, hypothetically, Nick Raimondo had taken that penalty kick and got it, and Nat Borchers hit his, and then whomever it was next on Sporting Kansas City hit theirs, and then Lavelle Palmer missed his still, because as much as I watched that penalty kick, it's quite clear that there was no way Lavelle Palmer was handling that pressure in that moment and would have hit it. Jason Kreis would have been questioned about letting Nick Raimondo take it. It's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't situations. I don't think that any coach in his right mind would let their goalkeeper take a penalty kick prior to a field player. And it's happened before. You know, it happens with Dan Kennedy. It's happened with Matt Reese before. But the fact of the matter is, as someone who, you know, is relatively comfortable with this league and is relatively comfortable with how Nick Raimondo plays out of the back with his feet, I would not have put him before Lavelle Palmer, no matter how cold Lavelle Palmer was coming into this game, just based on looking back on it.
It would be crazy for any coach to do something like that. You mean like when Luis Felipe Scolari did it in Portugal in Euro 2004? Hey, did has Luis Felipe Scolari won any trophies on the international stage? Like possibly the biggest pasta. Abram just pulled his hood over his face. All right, we'll just move on after that happened.
Number four.
There were some crazy festivities this weekend in Kansas City. Kansas City has hosted two World Cup qualifiers in this cycle. They hosted a Gold Cup game in 2011, and they just hosted MLS Cup and the All-Star game this year. Number four on the first 11 says, it's official. Kansas City is now Soccer City, USA.
I disagree. Slightly. And it sounds strange based on the fact of how much I rip on Seattle. But I think if we're looking as far as something being Soccer City, USA, you cannot look past what's been done in Seattle and Portland. I think Kansas City has a claim for being Soccer City, USA. I spent a lot of time over this last couple of weekends reading international articles. The idea of it being Soccer City, USA came up a lot. And I cannot look past Portland. Portland, in my mind, is Soccer City, USA. More than Seattle, and definitely more than Kansas City, Kansas.
Hey, Abram, have you ever been to Portland?
I have not been to Portland.
Okay, have you ever been to Seattle?
I have been to Seattle, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Never mind then. There goes my whole argument. But no, so I agree with this, and I actually don't think Kansas City is now Soccer City, USA. I think Kansas City is now Soccer City, comma, world. Kansas City is such a great place for soccer. They don't have a lot of competition in the major leagues. Their stadium is amazing. Not only is it amazing, but I believe it's expandable to 30,000 seats, which may happen. I don't know. Sporting Kansas City is selling everything out. Their stadium isn't even downtown. If you live in Kansas City, Missouri, you have to go to the other state to watch it, but it's such a great stadium. The fans are there are awesome. They're loud. They're passionate. It's hosted you know, multiple U.S. games. Not only that, but it's a great location because it's in the middle of the country. So everywhere, both coasts can be satisfied, I guess, with this as a soccer city. I think that all of the U.S. big games should be in Kansas City now. I mean, maybe it's blasphemy to suggest that against the status quo, which has been Columbus for such a long time. But I just think Kansas City has so much going on for it right now. And now that they have an MLS Cup champion to go with it, there's no way that this team or that this city is not Soccer City, USA.
All right.
Unless it's Soccer City World.
If you're looking at Kansas City, and both you and I have been to a sporting park now. It was Livestrong Park when I went there. And it is, mm-hmm. And you've been to a lot more soccer-specific stadiums in the country due to your MLS road trip than I have ever been to. I've only been to maybe three or four, not counting some of these small lower division ones. I agree that they have the best stadium, or at least the best stadium I've ever been to. When I look overall, though, as far as, and you mentioned the best fans or their loudest fans or something, I cannot get over what happened in Seattle during, I believe it was World Cup qualifying. It may have been the Gold Cup, I'm trying to remember, and that's not striking me right about now. But
it's Panama 2-0. Yeah.
That was World Cup qualifying. Okay, I couldn't remember. That, bar none, was the best support I've seen for the U.S. maybe ever. Portland didn't even come close to that, and I stated that I would take Portland, at least Portland MLS fans, over Seattle fans. I don't think Sporting Kansas City is quite there. I don't think Kansas City is quite there to the level that Seattle and Portland is. Do they have a better team based on the recent results and recent trophies? Yeah, they have a better team, but as far as calling them Soccer City USA over those two particular cities, I just can't bring myself to do.
Let me say something that I might get in trouble for saying, but I've been to all three of those cities that we're talking about. I mean, I guess we've sort of narrowed it down to Portland, Seattle, Kansas City. I love all three of those cities. I love them a lot, and I love going to soccer games in all three of those cities, but the difference between the fans in Portland and Seattle and the fans in Kansas City are, well, actually, it's more just the fans in Portland. The fans in Portland are very much, this is our thing, and they're not really, like, inclusive. They kind of liked it better when the team wasn't even in MLS, to be honest. A lot of them did. One of the fans told me that he liked it better because not everyone knew about it. In Kansas City, it was all like, hey, you want to watch soccer? Sweet. You know, like, this is awesome. And when I was there, they lost to the Columbus Crew 2-1, and they still partied. It was awesome. They got down in their own private fan bar that's in the stadium, and they partied with their, you know, $2 microbrews that you can get there for ridiculously cheap. It's just an awesome situation. The fans are totally amazing, and you know, maybe Portland edges them in terms of creativity, but Kansas City definitely edges them in terms of welcomeness. And I think if you're trying to build soccer in a country, that's what's more important.
Obviously, we both agree that there is a Soccer City USA, and it's one of these three cities. And I think it's good that we can all agree that Soccer City USA is not Foxborough, Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah.
We are going to move into our first break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the MLS Cup Finals rating, because that's what podcasts do. We're going to be talking about the reentry draft, which I don't care about. And we're going to be talking about what may or may not been a little slip-up by Don Garber. All that and a little bit more when we come back on the break. This is the First 11 on the AASB Sporting Network. Then I call Tay, put the pedal to the floor. Before we do the shop, gotta stop by the store. I'm on my knees, gotta go to the Lord. I pray to you, these things ain't gonna pay for it. All them times that I win, ignore it. So what, it wasn't 20, but still I scored. My heart still scorned and my mind is focused. So this serves as a warning to protest. Any verse disperses, sicker than the first. And it's all right, welcome back from our break. We're going to be delving into the wonderful, weird world of MLS and its wonderfully weird offseason.
Number 5.
Something that happens often with MLS, especially when it gets to the finals, is everyone tries to take out these big ideas from the television ratings. Last couple of years, the ratings have been bad, but not horrendous. This year, two small market teams played. Number 5 on our first 11 states, a 0.5, meaning approximately 500,000 people, television rating for the MLS Cup Finals, down 0.2 from last year, should have ESPN rethinking their deal with MLS.
I completely disagree with this. I don't think this number is fair at all. Last year, MLS Cup had the LA Galaxy, probably the biggest brand in MLS. They had Clint Dempsey. It had Landon Donovan. It had Landon Donovan. It had Robbie Keane. It had David Beckham, three of the biggest names in MLS. It had a pseudo big market in Houston. And the ratings were only 0.2 better. This year, we had almost no marketable stars, unless you count Graham Zuzi, penalty kick legend, as a star. And it had, who's the next best one? Matt Beisler? I don't even know. But, like, it had the two smallest markets, two of the smallest markets in the league, not a lot of national ambience, and it was going up against a huge college football game at the same time. I think it's amazing that this game drew as well as it did compared to last year. I think ESPN should not be reevaluating the deal. I think that these ratings are, while not great, are where ESPN probably wants them to be in terms of, can we see an improvement on this? So I disagree with this statement.
All right, so we're down 0.2 from last year. We're down 0.3 from the year before. The Colorado-Dallas final, which everyone was joking about, we're actually down 0.1 from there. we have a very low rating. Less than a million people is always pathetic. I talked a little bit about this on the last podcast about how they need to be aiming and need to be around a 1.0. When you had a 0.7 and a 0.8, and you do essentially have Real Salt Lake, who is recognized at least by soccer fans as being the best team or the best playing team in MLS, and you have Sporting Kansas City, who again, small market, but you know who else plays in a small market? The Kansas City Chiefs. I get that the NFL and the NBA and the NHL, to a point, are always going to have higher ratings than MLS Cup Finals. And that's just in their regular season games. I do not try to compare this to the Super Bowl, and I think that the MLS Cup may not ever get to Super Bowl level. It might not even get to SEC Championship level at that. But the fact that it's at a 0.5, meaning that, do you know what movie currently outrated MLS Cup Final playing at the same time, Evan?
No.
Fred Claus. Fred Claus, starring Paul Giamatti and Vince Vaughn, drew in more viewers than the MLS Cup Final. That's something of concern.
Did you list Paul Giamatti before you listed Vince Vaughn?
You always list Paul Giamatti before Vince Vaughn. He's an Academy Award winner. I can't look at this rating without being embarrassed by it.
Well, you know what they say. They say Real Salt Lake is cursed. Yeah. All right. Go
for Monterey.
Number 6.
On Monday, that is Monday the 9th of December 2013, MLS announced the players that were available for the reentry draft. Amongst those players was LA Galaxy defender and pseudo midfielder Sean Franklin. Number six on the first 11 says that Sean Franklin is the best pickup available in this MLS reentry draft.
First off, I want to begin this by saying the reentry draft is stupid. It's absolutely dumb. But with that in mind, with me sort of laying out that groundwork, based on the pseudo-slavery indentured servitude that is the MLS reentry draft, Sean Franklin is the best pickup. This is a first 11 quality right back in a league that struggles for any sort of outside back. This is a player who could essentially give some width in the midfield. Now, he's a little bit expensive for what he offers. About $225K was reported by Jonathan Tannenwald at Philly.com. So about $225K is a little much for what he may end up fully offering. But if you look at the other people on this list who could make an impact, you've got Dwayne DiRosario, $600K, way too much money. You've got Kenny Cooper, who's probably going to be due something around the lines of $325. Fabian Espindola, going to be due well over $425. You've got Steve Zakawani, which is a crapshoot. Who knows what's going to come out of that? David Ferreira, too old. Justin Braun, does Justin Braun even still play soccer? I don't know. So yeah, Sean Franklin is the best available pickup in the indentured servitude that is the MLS reentry draft.
So, Abram, you say that Sean Franklin is first 11 quality?
Well, if we're living in a world where wingbacks actually make the first 11.
So, no, are you saying that he's first 11 quality?
I'm saying he's first 11 as in being one of the top one or two right backs in this league.
Okay, so he's first 11 quality is what you're saying.
He was first 11 quality.
I'm looking for a one-word answer. He's first 11 quality is what you're saying.
That is quite possibly the answer that I'm saying, but I will not give you not give you satisfaction, sir.
So we should have him on the podcast then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If he's good enough to be on our podcast.
That's the first 11 you were talking about, right?
Well played.
There are a multitude of different options available on the reentry draft. Who knows how it really works? Actually, I do. I just don't feel like explaining it. But in my mind,
collusion. Excuse me.
In my mind, any right back who is good, yes, Sean Franklin is good, but he's probably not worth the $200K plus. Any right back that you can get, no matter how good, is inherently less valuable than a left back that you can get. 9 times out of 10. The worst player on any field in MLS is the left back. Think of how many bad left backs are in MLS, except for Chris Klute. Now, Seattle Sounders, for whatever reason, have decided that they do not like to, they would not like to pick up Mark Birch's option. Why not give Mark Birch a chance? He's an above average left back. Is Sean Franklin a better player? Absolutely. Is Mark Birch a better left back comparatively to the other left backs in the league? I'd probably say so. I would take a chance on Mark Birch. Any team could use him.
It's, I guess it's part of this has to do with how you're looking at the best pickup. Are you looking at the best value, the best player, or the best, I guess, rating of the player? And I tend to agree with the fact that Chris Clute is by far the best left back in the league right now. But I don't think that there's much of a step down from Sean Franklin and whoever the best right back is. Maybe that in itself, maybe I just made your argument for you as far as that goes. But I still think that if you're looking at best available pickup, it is Sean Franklin.
Well, I mean, if it was the best available player, then we'd be talking about Wells Thompson. But unfortunately, yeah, I mean, who would not want the biggest hack in the league on their team? I hope Wells Thompson. I'm sure Wells Thompson is a nice guy off the field. I really hope he's not in the league next year.
Oh, God. Number 7. Earlier this week, Brian Strauss put out an interview with Don Garber. Amongst the many sort of typical soccer Don things that went out there, there was one particular quote that stuck out more than any. When asked about failures for the league, Garber, after much running around, says, "Let's call it a setback. That's a good one. This will be provocative. We didn't get it right, and we still don't have it right with Chivas USA." Number 7 on the first 11 stakes. Don Garber going just short of calling Chivas USA a failure is the best thing to happen to that franchise in years.
I completely disagree. One word, Chelis. Oh my God, how was that not the best thing that ever happened to Chivas USA ever? Not in years, but in their existence. So I guess, 9 years now? We're going on, next year will be number 10. Chelis was hilarious. He brought a lot of publicity. Now, the team was not good. And I don't know if it was him or someone else who traded away Juan Agudelo, but and, you know, every other marketable or pseudo-marketable star that Chivas USA had. But, it's hard for, some people say any press is good press, but bad press like that is not good. It's not good for – when the commissioner of your league is admitting that he probably shouldn't have ever made this team in the first place, that's like – a parent telling their kid that they never wanted to have them. It's like if my mom were to come up to me and say, Evan, well, I did want you at one point, but now I don't. You know how that would make me feel? Chivas USA.
It's all right. First off, I agree with you with the fact that Chelis is awesome, was awesome.
Yeah, all right.
But he's not the best thing to have in that team. That team was horrendous. They were playing at any given time, 2 or 3 players in the back. Who does that? No one does that. So, yeah, this is the best thing to happen to the franchise in years. Not for your typical reasons. This is the best thing to happen to Chivas in years because, guess what? Major League Soccer knows they exist. They're aware that there's a problem there. They're aware they need to fix something. They just don't know what to do because Jorge Vergara, way more powerful than Don Garber, not a whole lot he can do, but the fact that there's at least a note of interest and a note that there's something going on in LA other than the Galaxy is the best thing to happen to Chivas USA in a long, long time, even if it does involve the commissioner essentially calling them a failure.
May I read you a quote?
You may.
From Jorge Vergara. So
this should be gold.
This quote says, "If you don't speak Spanish, you can go work for the Galaxy. Unless you speak Chinese, which is not even a real language." I don't have a point to that quote. I just kind of wanted to read it because of how ridiculous it was. Chivas USA's owner, everyone.
We're going to head into our break. When we come back, we've got sort of a mishmash amalgamation of different topics, including Nelson Mandela, the World Cup in Brazil, the Atlantis Silverbacks, and of course, everyone's favorite movie, starring Dom Dwyer.
Soccer hipsters unite! from important states like Massachusetts and California, to states no one gives a shit about, like New Hampshire and Alabama. A bunch of random guys with varying ratios of fanhood to non-biased journalism gather to talk about soccer, to drink alcoholic beverages, to give each other crap, and most importantly, to wake everyone up to the truth. It's Pick Up Soccer, available on the AASB Network. They babble on with empty pawns. I think about my last dollar while you holler for these rap songs. I'm in my eating when I rap about what I believe in. No deceiving, Illuminati got that ass licking. Yo, should I even rap or will I ever blow? Or should I take the loot?
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. So for once on this show, we're going to move on to somewhat of a more serious note, because a couple of days ago, we did, we being the world, did lose a cultural icon and true difference maker in Nelson Mandela. So we do want to express our condolences to the Mandela family and everyone in South Africa and everyone who's been affected by him.
Number eight.
The other day in the Turkish league, Ivory Coast players Didier Drogba and Emmanuel Eboué of Galatasaray took their shirts off after the game, and both of them had pro Mandela messages on written on their shirts. Now, I think this was, well, we'll get into what I think of it, but the Turkish Football Federation has decided to fine Didier Drogba and Emmanuel Eboué for their actions, saying that they weren't sanctioned and they don't give the league a good message globally. So number 8 on the first 11 says that some things are bigger than football. The Turkish Football Federation should not fine Didier Drogba and Emmanuel Eboué for their Nelson Mandela shirts.
I had to think a while about this one, on how I was going to go in and handle this. I want to disagree with this in the most sort of, I guess, respectful way possible. And that sort of goes back to what we were talking about during the first segment about Aurelien Collin and the idea of a rule is a rule is a rule. Unfortunately, the removing of your shirt is always supposed to be a yellow card, is always supposed to be a fine. And you cannot simply change that rule despite the fact that someone is in mourning, or in that case, the whole world was in mourning. If suddenly, and this is me playing it super hyperbolically, if they say that's okay for them to show the Nelson Mandela shirt, then what's to say it's not wrong for someone else to show something else political or some mourning towards someone who is not the same character and the same sort of person that Mandela was? It's a difficult one to argue against, and I'm saying this with as much respect as I possibly can, but the Turkish Football Federation does have to do what they think is right, and they do have to follow their own rules, and unfortunately they can't just make up the rules as they go since they're not MLS.
So, and if I understood the ESPN FC article correctly, I believe it was after the game that they were actually removed their shirts. And so the reason why they're being fined is just because it has a political message and they were photographed doing it, which is essentially the issue is not is it a FIFA rule, but are they censoring some possible political statements that the players are making? I think that not only in this circumstance where Nelson Mandela, in my opinion, was clearly a difference maker and clearly a civil rights leader and clearly affected many people's lives in a positive way. So not only is this a positive statement, but players should have the right to make these kinds of statements, especially if it's not during the game. I mean, you can go argue as much as you want with the taking off your shirt thing, and that's fine. Stupid rule anyway. But after the game, authoritative government. I can't even speak right now. It's so 1984 of them, I guess.
We're going to move on from this one and not get into our normal sort of ridiculous side discussion on this. I think it is a tougher issue than just simply following the rules or not.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that you or I are really equipped to make the full argument on this. That should be probably left to non-pseudo-journalists, maybe some people who could dig a little deeper, or people who are actually in Turkey. I easily see both sides of this, but it's a tough issue and a tough time to sort of make any sort of light comment on, I guess.
Yeah.
Number nine.
As we are sort of winding down and getting into our last couple of topics, there's a couple names on everyone's mind. Ghana, Portugal, and Germany. Number nine on the first 11 states. The bar of success for the U.S. men's national team in Brazil officially changed after being drawn into the group of death.
Completely disagree with this one. I mean, if the United States wants to improve as a soccer country, they should be expecting to win their group every single time, no matter who is in the group. Yes, it is a tough draw, but why should the U.S. change their expectations just because of a draw? When I spoke with a name drop, Sonny Ogilati, last summer, he told me that the goal was to get out of the group and see what happens. That should be the minimum requirement for any World Cup. The minimum should be get out of the group, right? The maximum should be how many games can we win from there? And that should be the same regardless of any group that the United States is in. If USA wants to be one of the top soccer nations in the world, which it is not, then they're going to have to set high expectations. If anything, the bar should be raised.
I don't think you can raise the bar. I think that the bar has definitely been changed as far as what is successful for them. If they win the group, it would be the most amazing thing in the history of the United States men's national team, short of actually winning the World Cup. Second place in the group should be completely acceptable. Third place in the group should be completely acceptable. Pulling a single point from this group may not be acceptable, but I would not be embarrassed if all they can do is get there and pull out one point. So yeah, the bar of success has changed. Do I want them out of the group? Yes, but if they do 3-0-0 draws, I think I could live with that. I think I could be happy. If they do not go into that group and if they do not come out of that group completely embarrassed, that is a successful World Cup tournament to me. Will it be a successful World Cup tournament to the casual fans, to the people who only watch soccer once every 4 years? Probably not. But when you have a team, and again, Germany, Portugal, Ghana, a couple of points here or there are just not being thoroughly whooped, should be looked at maybe not as a success, but not as a failure.
No.
Number 10.
All right, so the Atlanta Silverbacks, for those of you who listen to our podcast just for the mainstream coverage, which we don't apparently do at all, just fired their head coach, Brian Haynes, who did lead them to the Soccer Bowl and the, Apertura Championship of NASL, the opening championship. So number 10 on the first 11 says, the Atlanta Silverbacks firing head coach Brian Haynes is a sign of the eventual hiring of our very favorite person of all time, Eric Winalda.
Eric Winalda is the Lord and Savior of U.S. soccer. You know that. I know that. Don Garber knows that. Sunil Gulati knows that. And I'm not exactly sure how sarcastic I'm being now. It might just be a little bit of sarcasm. It might be no sarcasm at all. Winalda transformed that team, and he's sort of been, or that team being the Atlanta Silverbacks. He's been sitting on the sidelines, not necessarily coaching them, but running it as their technical director. He was in charge of hiring Brian Hayes. He was in charge of basically throwing together this roster. He was the one who found Chris Clute, who you were talking about earlier, as this sort of, I don't want to say revolutionary, but as the best left back currently playing in MLS. This team, Brian Hayes not only led the team to the spring championship, he was also named the NASL Coach of the Year. He was fired. There is no way that this firing has nothing to do, double negative, with an eventual hiring of Eric Winalda. Winalda is coming, folks. Winalda is coming.
So, last year, I was invited to attend a college soccer game between two of the top teams in the United States. And I'm not going to say who, because I don't think it's fair for me to name these coaches on air. And after the game, the two coaches, who are once again coaches of top programs, I was near them when they spoke about Eric Winalda. This was a little bit after the Cal FC sort of run to the quarterfinals, I believe, in U.S. Open Cup. These two coaches who produce MLS quality talent every single year. I know this because there, two very high national programs. These two coaches were joking about Eric Winalda. They were talking about how every single player on the team referred to, you know, sort of thought that Winalda was, he was, well, like I said, a joke. He apparently hardly showed up to training sessions. It was all the assistant coach, the other guy from Fox Football Phone, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now, but apparently he didn't really actually do anything for Cal FC. His tactics were a joke, his team was a joke, and he actually took more of the credit than he deserved. There's no way that Atlanta is going to hire him as their coach if they know this, and I believe they know this because two college coaches know this, and I think this is absolutely ridiculous and false. And as much as I would like to see someone who says a lot of stupid shit like Eric Winalda get have a bigger platform, I just don't see it happening.
I've heard similar stories, and I'm not quite as in as you seem to be with some of the college coaches, but I have heard stories of people at coaching conferences saying the same sorts of things about Eric Winalda. And I think a lot of this has to do with his arrogance is not the word I'm looking for, although it does seem relatively apt as far as he goes. He may not be considered a tactical genius, but he is someone who has done things for Atlanta in the past. Atlanta was pathetic. I mean, utterly and completely pathetic before he essentially took over as their coach in 2012, and he did a decent job as their coach. He's done a great job as their technical director, and I guess maybe that is his additional role. I just can't see Atlanta, a team which is, and I'm not sure if it's a silverback so much as it is just Arthur Blank, but I can't see Atlanta, a city which is showing somewhat of a proclivity towards making Atlanta bigger, or the silverbacks, excuse me, bigger than they are, firing their coach of the year without having something up their sleeves. You're not going to get a huge name to come and coach in NASL. And I think Eric Winalda, regardless of what people think about him, is probably the biggest name that Atlanta or any other NASL team could hire.
And just to further argue my side, I just recalled that actually this one of the two coaches said that he talked to Merritt Paulson because there was this whole idea of the Eric Winalda Merritt Paulson interview, and apparently Merritt Paulson was just like, what the fuck? Like, no, you're not getting an interview for our job. That's ridiculous. Like, it was just more of a Winalda sort of begged him for the opportunity to do that, and Merritt Paulson never really took it seriously. Not that Merritt Paulson, well, you know, there's this whole thing about if you have nothing to say nice to say about someone, don't say it. So Merritt Paulson, everyone.
No, it's not like Merritt Paulson could hire a good coach anyway. All he got was Caleb Border.
No, wait. Great coach.
Wait, yeah, okay. That's the opposite of what I wanted to argue.
Number 11.
So Sporting Kansas City is officially your MLS Cup champions. And of all the things that have happened since then, especially as far as we go with the retirement of the Puma, one of the more heralded stories from one of the more heralded players, despite a relatively quiet MLS Cup final, with our favorite future movie star, Dom Dwyer, who may be going on loan to either Birmingham City or the Wolverhampton Wanderers. So number 11 on our first 11 states, Dom Dwyer going to either Birmingham City or Wolverhampton would be the ultimate ending to the Dom Dwyer movie.
No way. It's completely disagree. The ultimate ending to the Dom Dwyer movie would be him hoisting the CONCACAF Champions League trophy. Do you know why, Abram? Because that way people might know about the tournament.
I think the ultimate ending would be him going to Norwich City and peeing on everyone because they're calling him a Norwich City reject.
And ooh, that's just mean. What about joining forces with another Norwich City reject, Kai Kamara, at Middlesbrough?
Ooh, two Sporting Kansas City players?
Ooh, dude, we can have Kansas City, UK.
It'd be like Yoda there. And Luke Skywalker joining up at the end of Star Wars.
Which one is Yoda? Which one is Yoda and which one's Luke Skywalker?
Yoda is clearly Kai Kamara. Clearly.
Really? Because of all the, like, wise sayings he has?
Because of the fact that he's awesome, a Jedi, and short.
he's like one of those things. Yeah. He's a Jedi.
true, truthfully, I don't quite get this. I love Dom Dwyer, and this is, you know, it's sort of an ongoing inside joke. I think we talked about the Dom Dwyer movie about 8 times, and the fact that we're writing it, or at least I am in my head. Maybe there'll be a short video about that.
Really, I am on paper. So, oh, are you?
No, but why? This is not the MLS player I'd go after. Is it simply just because he's English already, and they'll save time trying to get him a work permit, as we saw failed miserably with Juan Agudelo?
Probably.
This is not the player in MLS who I'd go after. But yeah, I think for an ending of our fictitious Dom Dwyer movie, it'd be a pretty epic ending.
What we need to do for our movie is get a scene, and Dom Dwyer has to play Dom Dwyer.
Oh, obviously.
We need to get a scene with Dom Dwyer and David Beckham in the same room and just have them talk to each other with their little girl voices, and David Beckham's apparently meth face, and then we can, that's a movie.
Are they both going to be wearing Union Jack as capes?
No, just Beckham. It was so fashionably tied. It was more of a scarf.
That's one of my favorite MLS Cup moments, is him wearing the Union Jack, Beckham wearing the Union Jack, and then them quickly taking it off and throwing the American flag around him.
Do you know what my favorite MLS Cup moments were?
Oh, God, I'm going to hate you. Go ahead.
Carlos Ruiz, 2002.
Oh, I hate you so much. I was at that game.
Dwayne De Rosario, 2007. What am I missing? Oh, El Pando Ramirez in 2005. Those are my top four MLS Cup moments.
None of those things happened. None of them.
Clint Dempsey playing well in an MLS Cup. Oh, wait, sorry. That never happened.
All right. So before I murder Evan, we're going to quickly move on to a couple of our reserves. And I'm only going to hit a couple of these. All right. So first reserve, Juan Agudelo will succeed in Europe.
Can he get to Europe?
Yeah, that's a good question. I disagree. Mostly because I want him back in New England. All right. Bruce Arena has no right to be up for the CONCACAF Coach of the Year award.
What are the other, who are the other candidates for that? I mean,
it looks like Jurgen Klinsmann and a bunch of like coaches from Panama and Mexico.
Is the Oompa Loompa coach from Mexico on it?
I would guess not.
No, the guy, the Club America coach. I can't remember his name.
I don't know, I'd have to look it up. I didn't realize the CONCACAF champions, the CONCACAF awards really existed and had fan votes. But you can go over there and vote. You know who's up for Player of the Year? Jerry Benson.
It's just as important as our inaugural end of season awards, which we'll get to in 2 weeks.
Yeah. All right. What do we got? The Canadian Championship, or whatever it's called, should include Canadian teams outside of NASL and MLS.
No, there's no way that should happen. Disagree, because that way it might even be like a real trophy.
Yeah, we don't need a real trophy, and Canada doesn't even play soccer.
If Toronto has won it, it's not a real trophy.
All right. And our last reserve is the World Cup draw was obviously rigged. I mean, obviously.
More than MLS Cup final.
Yeah, I disagree, because only an idiot would think that.
No, he was feeling Cannavaro. He knew which ones were the hot balls and which ones were the cold ones. It was just like the 1985 NBA lottery where Patrick Ewing somehow ended up at the New York Knicks.
Or Tim Duncan to the Spurs in whatever year that was. Anyway. Why are we talking about basketball? We talk about basketball too much on this podcast.
Shoot ball is not a real sport.
So you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Mind of Abram. He's at Evan Ream. You can follow the show at First 11 Pod. Our pseudo network is at the AASP. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/All American Soccer Pod. We are on the iTunes under the All American Soccer Podcast. So go ahead and rate or review us there. I know you have some plugs, Evan.
Oh, so this week I was driving this week to school every day. It takes me about 5 minutes, and literally though, I'm like 6 blocks away. And you know what? I was like, you know, I'm going to start listening to a new podcast, and I will listen to this podcast 5 minutes at a time, and it'll take me about 3 weeks to finish the podcast. And so I was like, well, what podcast can I look to soothe this void, to fill this void in my life? And you know, I found one actually, and it's called the Midnight Ride Podcast. Just check it out at TMR Podcast. They're there's some guys on there. They say some things very, very entertaining. Unfortunately, I've only gotten through 7/38 of this most recent episode, but it's out there. It's quality stuff. You guys should all check it out. We all love our favorite pseudo podcast host in Hisco Alejandro. I don't know what he's calling himself these days. So I just like to plug at TMR podcast.
Yeah. All right. So if you haven't yet, go ahead. Probably put it up on the All American Soccer Podcast website, which means it may end up on iTunes, which is The Ghost of Monterey. Go check that out. It's an entertaining 4.5 minutes of your life, unless you're an RSL fan. Then take away all your belts and shoelaces and make sure you have taken copious amounts of alcohol before watching it. Regardless,
but they don't have that in Utah.
Yeah, so I've heard. This is episode 6 of the First 11 podcast, and we're sorry.
Yeah, we really are this time.
What episode are we on? The fifth? Sixth?
Six. Six. This is our Dunga episode.
I prefer to think of it as our Kyle Beckerman episode.
Yeah, I was like, I'm a journalist.
Sort of.
Pseudo. I write articles.
Yeah. Alright. I podcast, guys. Yeah, whatever.
I have a podcast, and my friend made a video about Real Salt Lake. So, I mean,
I believe you need
kind of a big deal.
That's good on the outtake.